A chill wind blows on a black night. The place, Washington, D.C., the capital of a divided nation. It has been a rain-filled April. Pennsylvania Avenue is awash with mud and muck. The city sleeps, but it's a mournful sleep. One of those who mourns is the wife of the President of the United States. Abraham Lincoln has been assassinated. One 100 years ago tonight, President Lincoln was dead. He had died in the morning from an assassin's bullet fired the night before. And a century ago on this evening, the hunt for the man who killed Lincoln was well underway. The hunted John Wilkes Booth. Let us go back 100 years and relive those hours. Let us meet the people who walked in the shadow of Lincoln. Some who loved him, some who hated him. These are the last days of Lincoln.
This 5-part series is brought to you by Twin City Federal, headquarters for savings accounts, home loans, and home improvement loans, and by the Lincoln National Life Insurance Company of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and your Lincoln Life general agents in the Twin Cities, Lynn M. Elling and Associates of Minneapolis, James J. Sheehan and Associates, St. Paul. Now, 100 years ago tonight, the last days of Lincoln.
Trace the steps of Lincoln and those around him during the last days of his life. Now we enter the Black Night, the night in which President Lincoln lived out the last moments of his mortal life. It had all happened so suddenly, people would say that later, but their opinions would ring false to at least one man, John Wilkes Booth, who had schemed and plotted, waiting for this to come. For the cunning actor, it all happened right on schedule. There was nothing sudden about it. The same was true of the men who conspired with Booth and carried out their own parts of the plan. There was Lewis Payne, whose job it was to assassinate the Secretary of State, William H. Seward. In this he failed, but it was only a near miss. Even as Booth prepared to pull a trigger in Ford's Theater, Lewis Payne was charging through the Seward home like a maddened bull. When he fled from the house, the Secretary of State lay on the floor beside his bed in a growing pool of blood. He had been stabbed several times. A male nurse in the bedroom had also been stabbed, and a White House messenger in the house lay dead on the landing of the steps, a long blade in his chest. Such was the carnage that Lewis Payne left in his wake. His companion, David Harold, had left for parts unknown, frightened away by the screams which he heard come from the Seward home. And what of another conspirator, George Atzerodt, whose assignment was to slay the Vice President, Andrew Johnson? Atzerodt, the Prussian carriage maker from Port Tobacco, Virginia, wound up by getting drunk instead, and the Vice President was unharmed. And so, Lincoln sits in the presidential box in Ford's Theater, holding his wife's hand. Behind him, the white door leading to Box 7 has been left unguarded, because the man assigned to that job, John Parker, was enjoying a drink in a nearby bar instead. It is just before 10:30. The play, Our American Cousin, is nearing the end. Even as the players on stage speak their lines, John Wilkes Booth tightens his finger on the trigger of his derringer.
I'm aware, Mr. Trenchard, that you are not used to the manners of good society.
Booth braced himself. His finger began tightening on the tiny trigger. He leaned forward.
The manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, you suck. Dologizing old man trap.
In the laughter that followed that burlesque line, the sound of a shot could barely be heard. But Mrs. Lincoln heard it. She turned at the noise, her face still creased with the laughter of a moment before. Her guests, Major Rathbone and Claire Harris, also heard the shot. A cloud of blue smoke hung in the box as John Wilkes Booth looked at them and announced, "Sic Semper Tyrannis, death to the tyrant." Lincoln, sitting in the red velvet armchair, inclined his chin forward to his chest, as if asleep. Booth wasted no time. He forced his way between the president and Mary Lincoln. Mrs. Lincoln's laughter turned to confusion as the major sprang at Booth. The actor slashed at Rathbone with a long blade and moved to the edge of the box. "Revenge for the South," cried Booth, and he bolted over the edge of the presidential box. Here, his plan soured. The spur on the right foot caught in a flag on the front of the box, and when he dropped to the stage 11 feet below, he felt something snap. He had broken his left foot, but he managed to make it across the stage in an awkward run, and in seconds was astride his horse and galloping full tilt up the alley behind the theater. Back in the theater, a piercing scream sliced through the air. It was Mary Lincoln, who had just realized that something awful had happened. The scream put the theater into a frenzy. The aisles were jammed. A group of men tried to get into the doorway leading to the presidential box, but they could not. Booth's idea of jamming the door shut with a length of pine worked well. Major Rathbone, blood streaming down his clothes, finally removed the board, and men streamed into the box. One of the first to enter was Dr. Charles Leal, assistant surgeon of the United States Volunteers. He was 23 years old.
Let me look at him.
Doctor, is he dead? Can he recover? Oh, my dear husband. My dear husband.
Please, Mrs. Lincoln, I must examine him. Rathbone, get me a lamp. Lock that door back there in a bit. No one but the doctors. You soldiers there, get him out of the chair and put him on the floor.
The young doctor examined the president. Lifting an eyelid, he saw evidence of a brain injury. Then he found the small hole well behind Lincoln's left ear. Even to the young surgeon, it was apparent that Lincoln was going to die. Lincoln's relaxed body was carried by four husky soldiers out of the theater. They took him to the home of William Peterson at 453 10th Street, across the street. A steady roar of the crowd could be heard as the strange procession made its way. Lincoln was carried to the second floor and was placed on a bed in a small bedroom under a stairway. The room was cleared. Guards were posted at the door. Mrs. Lincoln, in shocked bewilderment, waited in the front room with Miss Harris and Laura Keene, who had come from the theater where she had starred in the play. Young Dr. Leal held his first conference with other doctors.
I do not see how the president can survive his wound.
Yes, the ball apparently went in on the left side behind his ear and traveled toward his right eye. It's lodged in the brain now.
I believe all we can do is make him as comfortable as possible. The rest is in the hands of God.
And so, Abraham Lincoln, rail splitter, president, husband, and father, lay dying. There were just two things to be done: await his death and find the assassin. Official Washington was in panic, for no one knew how big the plot was. With the war just ended, it could be a huge conspiracy. Police and government investigators ran helter-skelter. In the chaos, Booth and his companions were nearly forgotten. Word of the assassination spread through the city. People went to their homes. The taverns closed. Some historians say that at this point, the government was run by a dictator. His name, Edwin McMaster Stanton, Secretary of War. He sat at a small table in the house where Lincoln lay dying and convened a court of inquiry. Witnesses were questioned, their answers recorded in shorthand. Stanton ordered guards placed around the homes of all cabinet members. He ordered the confiscation of Ford's Theater and the immediate arrest of all its employees.
There must be hundreds of assassins in Washington this very night. These terrorists must be arrested. Now, you, what is your name, please?
My name is Harry Hawk, sir.
Well, what do you know about all this? Speak up, man.
Well, I was on stage when it happened. I was the only one on stage at that point, I know.
And who did you see leap from the president's box?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I believe it was John Wilkes Booth. Still, I'm not positive that it was him. I mean, I only had one glance at him as he was running toward me. He had a dagger, you see, so I turned and ran. I remember I yelled, "That's John Wilkes Booth!"
And the investigation went on. But strangely enough, no calls went out for the arrest of Booth. His name was left out of all dispatches until the early hours of the morning. And for Booth, time was just what he needed. The man who murdered Lincoln 100 years ago, who caused his death a century ago tonight, was riding hard, and he was in pain. He had linked up with David Harold, who had left Lewis Payne inside the Seward home.
I'm telling you, you little fool. I must have broken my foot jumping from the box. Ooh, give me some of that whiskey.
What about Lincoln?
Have no fear. The Colossus of Rhodes will speak no more.
Well, I'm sure Payne took care of Seward, too. When I left, you could hear the screaming right out in the street. I didn't hang around there long, I can tell you that. I wonder how George made out.
That drunken fool. I'd be surprised if he even laid eyes on the vice president. Very much surprised. Now, let's put some distance between us and that foul city.
In this instance, John Wilkes Booth was right. George Atzerodt had not done his job, much to the relief of the nation and, of course, Vice President Andrew Johnson. Instead, Atzerodt got drunk and then tried to find a place to lay his head. He had heard the news, Lincoln assassinated, a madman loose in Seward's house, and he was scared. But he was also still in the Capitol. A friend of his managed a store, and he approached him to find out whether he could sleep in the back for the night.
Not on your life, George. Haven't you heard the news? Why, the president has been shot, and everything is busted loose in this town.
Come on, Briscoe. Just one night in the back of the place isn't going to hurt things.
Sorry, George. I just can't do it.
But...
Besides, the owner is at my place tonight, and I'll not have someone spending the night in his store while he's a guest of mine.
But just as a favor, just this once.
How many times do I have to repeat myself? The answer is no, George.
But no!
George Atzerodt ended up at a flophouse that night. He was perfectly satisfied. And what about Lewis Payne, who had trotted away from the Seward home with a servant shouting at his back? Payne was even worse off than Atzerodt. At least George had a roof over his head. Payne didn't even have that, for the simple reason that he got lost and mixed up in directions after leaving the Seward home, and he didn't have the slightest idea where he was. He spent the night in the woods outside of town. A tall man wearing a stovepipe hat entered the small bedroom where Lincoln lay on a bed. He was Dr. Robert King Stone, the Lincoln family physician. Others in the room looked on grimly as Stone examined the form on the bed. The doctor shook his head, muttered to himself, replaced the cover on Lincoln, and stood up.
This case is hopeless. The president will die. There is no positive limit to the duration of his life. He is tenacious. And he will resist, but death will close the scene.
In moments of quiet, the president's breathing could be heard. His wife had become completely unnerved and had to be kept out of the room. Secretary of War Stanton was still in the house, issuing orders, interrogating, sometimes shouting. The city was asleep now. 10th Street was deserted. So was Pennsylvania Avenue. The whistle from an occasional night train could be heard in the distance. The morning newspapers were being made up in major towns across the nation. New York, St. Louis, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia. The editors were preparing to go to press with the saddest story of the age. And one of the saddest men at that hour was Andrew Johnson, the vice president, whose life was spared because the man assigned to kill him had changed his mind. Johnson was in his room at the Kirkwood House. At 1 o'clock in the morning, on this day, 100 years ago, he was engaged in an argument.
Farwell, I don't give a whit for your advice. I tell you I've waited long enough to see Lincoln, and I'm not going to wait any longer.
But, sir, I can understand your feelings, but it may not be safe for you. The sewage can tell you that.
Well, I'm going. You can come along if you wish, but I'll have no carriage and no guards. I'll walk.
The vice president had little to say during his early morning walk over to the house, where his chief executive lay mortally wounded. He walked with his hat pulled down hard over his eyes, his coat collar up, his hands in his coat pockets. Once in the room where Lincoln lay, Johnson stood with hat in hand, staring down at the figure on the bed. And then he went to see Mary Lincoln, who was still keeping vigil in the front room.
Ma'am, I can't tell you how sorry I feel about all this. It's a terrible thing.
I wish that man had fired his weapon at me. Not Abe. Anything but this. I should bring little Tad here. If Abe'll speak to anyone, it'd be Tad. He loved him so.
Now there, Mrs. Lincoln. Robert, you should take your mother home. All this is a great strain on her. Good night, ma'am.
As Vice President Johnson returned to his hotel room, news was breaking across the city. For the first time, the name John Wilkes Booth had been made public in connection with the great crime, and the news had many repercussions. Ella Turner, a woman of the night who had loved Booth, heard the news and the mention of the actor's name. She went to her room, put a picture of Booth under her pillow, and pressed her head into a rag soaked with chloroform. In New York, there were threats upon the life of Booth's brother, Edwin. In the meantime, Booth was having troubles of his own. But of course, his troubles were just beginning. Early on the morning of this day, 100 years ago, John Wilkes Booth and his companion in crime, David Harold, had just passed the crossroads at Surrattsville. They were now more than 11 miles south of Ford's Theater. A bright moon shone on the rich countryside, and there was a chill in the air that cut through the cloth of the riders' coats. Booth was in pain.
Davy, my friend, I'm afraid I'm not going to stand much more of this. Let's get our equipment at the tavern and then see about getting this thing fixed. It's killing me.
The pair arrived at the tavern in Surrattsville. The saloon, managed by a Mr. Lloyd, was in darkness.
Open up in there! It's John Wilkes and Davy!
Must be asleep or something. Give it another try.
Open up in there, I say. Lloyd, open this dang door.
I'm coming. Just hold them horses. What do you mean, scaring the dickens out of a man at this time of night? What do you want, anyway?
You shut up, Lloyd, and give me a bottle of whiskey. Davy, get the guns from upstairs.
Sure,
and don't be all night about it. Lloyd, is there a doctor in this devil's country?
Well, the doc, Hoxton, down the road about a half mile or so, but he don't practice no more. He told me so himself. Here's your whiskey.
Oh, thank you.
How'd you hurt yourself? Fall off a horse or something?
No, you idiot. We just killed the tyrant tonight. That's all. President Lincoln.
Yeah, Lloyd, what do you think of that? You act as if that isn't news or something.
Use your own pleasure about that. I'm going to get me some sleep.
Go right ahead. Davy, give the man a dollar for his troubles, will you?
Yeah, sweet dreams, you old sot. Boy, what a barkeep that guy makes. How's the foot, John?
Oh, it's still bad. I've got to get to a doctor. There's no choice to it.
Well, we'll have to change directions then, too. The only other doctor in the area is Doc Mudd down at Bryantown. That's about 17 miles from here. Think you can make it?
David, I've no choice in the matter. I've got to make it.
At 2 o'clock in the morning on this day, 100 years ago, the police and federal investigators finally started making progress. They'd been running in circles since the mortal shot was fired. And even as the luck of John Wilkes Booth began to sour, so did the fortunes of others who had associated with him. At 2:15 in the morning, Washington Superintendent of Police John Clarvo was standing in front of a house at 541 H Street. It was the boarding house operated by the widow, Mary Surratt, the house where John Wilkes Booth was a regular visitor. They were friends, so much so that earlier in the week, Mrs. Surratt had taken a package to the tavern at Surrattsville for the actor. And it was the same package that Booth and Harold just picked up. As fate would have it, Mrs. Surratt would have a hard time explaining this coincidence to authorities.
All right, you men, spread out. Three of you take the back. We'll go in the front. I hear someone moving inside. They must be up.
Yes, who are you? What do you want?
I'm Detective Clarvo of the city police. You'll have to let us in. Is John Surratt here?
Oh, no, he's not in the city now.
Then let me speak with Mrs. Surratt, his mother.
Wait here and I'll get her. Would you mind telling us what this is all about?
Do you pretend to tell me you don't know what's happened tonight?
Yes, I pretend. What has happened that merits getting good people out of their beds at this hour of the morning?
I'll tell you what's happened. Do you see this bloody collar? That blood is from President Lincoln. He was shot down tonight in Ford's Theater. Moreover, he was shot by the actor, John Booth.
Oh, great heavens. But it is impossible. Did you hear that, Mrs. Surratt?
I don't believe it.
Mrs. Surratt, I'm going to ask you some questions. And I want you to be very particular about how you answer them, because a great deal depends on them. When did you last see John Wilkes Booth?
Why, I saw him at 2 o'clock today, just last afternoon.
You mean yesterday afternoon, the 14th?
Yes, yesterday afternoon.
Now, I want you to tell me about any meetings Mr. Booth had.
The detectives searched the boarding house, found nothing special, and left the house without making any arrests. But the day would come when they would make arrests. And for the widow, Mary Surratt, the days were numbered. At 3 o'clock in the morning on this day, 100 years ago, the doctors no longer bustled around the limp form of Abraham Lincoln. At this hour, they sat in their chairs in that tiny room of the Peterson home across from Ford's Theater. They looked at one another from time to time, they studied their own folded hands, and they glanced at the figure on the bed in front of them. It was only a matter of time. President Lincoln could not recover from his wound. This they knew. And so they waited a silent vigil as the minutes ticked by. The city itself was silent. Soldiers and investigators went here and there, but the populace itself was sound asleep. At this hour, 100 years ago, the fortunes of John Wilkes Booth grew steadily worse. John Wilkes Booth was still on the move, and he was still in pain. The throbbing pain in his left foot crawled up his back and into his brain, and every movement of his horse was like a fiery poker, gnawing, probing, sticking, and burning him. But help was in sight. They were approaching the home of Dr. Samuel Mudd in the raw hours of the morning. Booth had put on the disguise of an old man. A knock on the door, a moment's wait, and Dr. Mudd appeared. He was sullen-faced and businesslike, the same manner for which he'd been known for years.
It's just one of those crazy things that happened, Doc. He tumbled off the fool horse and liked to have busted his whole body. But his foot is in pretty bad shape, as you can see.
Well, let's have a look at it. Just lie back on the couch there. Huh? Yeah, kind of swollen, yeah. I'd say. Yeah. You boys must have ridden quite a pace tonight. I think I'll have to cut the top of this boot off.
Yeah, just go easy, Doctor. It's painful and tender, you understand?
I think you won't be traveling tonight anywhere, sir. No more. That's a pretty bad break we have here.
Yeah.
It's a fracture of the tibia, we call it, but no fracture in the adjoining bones.
Don't fiddle with it so, Doctor. I told you. It's painful.
Now, don't get upset, mister. I know what I'm doing. We'll make a simple splint to hold it in place, and time will do the rest. But mind you, stay off it. It won't take any weight. And I won't do that for several weeks yet.
And so, Booth had found shelter, and his foot was being treated. But back in Washington, no treatment could be found for the president of the nation. Abraham Lincoln still lay on the bed in the house on 10th Street. The doctors still maintained their vigil. Tears still flowed from the eyes of Mary Lincoln. Police and government men still scurried about the city in search of what they thought were hundreds of conspirators. Seconds ticked onward. The minutes passed, the hours departed, and by 7 in the morning on this day, 100 years ago, death roosted in the room in the house on 10th Street. A dark, reddish stain spread around the pillow under the president's head. His breathing was not regular, his pulse weakened. The doctors were helpless. They could do no more than watch their patient die. The sound of the patient's breathing would stop, and the doctors would pull out their watches to record the time of death. And then the breathing would begin again, slowly and hesitation, as if the next breath would surely be the last. Mary Lincoln remained in the front room. She would not go home. Too weak for conversation, she would look dumbly at the wall, lightened moment by moment as the dawn of the new day entered the room. By 7:15 on this morning, 100 years ago today, a light rain began falling in the capital of Washington. By now, the news had spread throughout the town, and the city was silent. The robins in the elms did not chatter on this morning. There was no hustle and bustle in the streets. By 7:20, there was no mistake about it. President Lincoln was nearly gone. His right eye was black, and he began moaning. The sound of his voice echoed through the home, and chills tingled up and down the spine of those who heard. Again, the doctors looked at their watches. Surgeon General Barnes glanced around the tiny room. Mrs. Lincoln was brought to the bedroom. Robert Lincoln gripped her shoulder as she stood by the bedside, staring down at the figure of her husband. Without a word, she left the room. By now, at 7:21 on this day, 100 years ago, President Lincoln was in his death struggle. Dr. Phineas Gurley, Lincoln's pastor, came in from the front parlor. At 22 minutes and 10 seconds past 7, On this day, 100 years ago, Abraham Lincoln drew his last breath. He would breathe no more. He would speak no more. He would be no more. The pastor knelt on the floor and began to pray.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen.
The young Dr. Charles Leal reached over to the bed and folded the arms of the dead president. He lifted an eyelid, listened closely for a heartbeat, a touch of pulse. It was no use. There was none. Lincoln was somewhere else now. Only his body remained behind. And so, the rail splitter was dead. He had entered office a despised and unwanted man. He died in office with a following that approached reverence. Abraham Lincoln, dead at 56, had traveled a long road, a road that took him from the homey charm of Kentucky to the cunning world of the nation's capital. He had walked that road in dignity, with a stubborn distaste for compromise and a human dedication to moral values. He did not stumble along the road. His step was alert and firm. His direction was straight and true. But now his journey was ended. Abraham Lincoln had become another page in history. The capital of Washington, bells tolled the news that Lincoln the president was no more. It was hard to believe. The townspeople looked grim as they tried to go about their morning work. Some swore and muttered oaths. Some wept. Mary Lincoln was hysterical. Robert Lincoln tried to comfort her. Tad Lincoln refused to believe. Telegraph keys chattered the news north, east, and west, and the bells tolled out the news in Boston, Chicago, and in Springfield. At mid-morning on this day, 100 years ago, a black hearse was drawn up in front of the house on 10th Street. An honor guard of soldiers took Lincoln's body from the room. A cold rain pounded down into the city as the hearse pulled away from the curbing and started on the solemn journey to the White House. So much for that day. But what lay ahead? For John Wilkes Booth, days of running and hiding lay ahead. But he could not run forever. He was shot down as a squad of soldiers surrounded an old barn. Days in a courtroom awaited those accused as conspirators. The widow, Mary Surratt, young Davy Harold, big burly Lewis Payne, the drunken bear, George Atzerodt. Those four would hang from their necks until dead on a hot July afternoon with a crowd of people looking on. Dr. Samuel Mudd was tried for conspiracy and imprisoned, along with Sam Arnold, the man who decided not to take part in the plot. Prison terms awaited Michael Laughlin, another who quit the plotting, and Ned Spangler, a stagehand at Ford's Theater, who was also accused. John Surratt, the son of Mary Surratt and a Confederate spy, ran to Canada and Europe. He, too, eventually reached trial, but he was acquitted and ended up giving lectures. His subject, the plot against Lincoln. And what of the others who were schemed against? Secretary of State William H. Seward recovered from the knife wounds inflicted by Payne. He died of old age 7 years after Lincoln's death. His son Frederick recovered from his wounds. Andrew Johnson was sworn in as president. He fired Secretary of War Stanton and later was impeached. Ulysses Grant in time also became president. He had a questionable term in office and wound up writing his memoirs to keep from dying penniless 20 years after the death of Lincoln. The last days of Lincoln were filled with moments of sadness. But the saddest were yet to come for Mary Lincoln. 6 years after the death of her husband, her youngest son, Tad, died. 10 years after the death of her husband, Mary's son, Robert, signed the necessary papers that installed her in an insane asylum. The woman was released after a year and spent the last years of her life in a darkened room wearing a widow's black. The last survivor of the story, Robert Todd Lincoln, died at the age of 83. That was in 1926. Such were the last days of Lincoln. They were tragic days, but not completely. The good part of those times remains with us today. Before the rail splitter left this mortal world, he cleared the way for the unity of our nation. The divided states were to become undivided, and it was Lincoln's planning that provided the stimulus for this great work. For maybe Lincoln knew that long after his death, our states would remain. And maybe he also knew that no assassin's bullet could prevent this work from being finished, could alter the great plan that cemented our nation into a single people. And so, even as Lincoln died, his hopes, his works, did not die. They are with us today, tonight, in the form of a nation. Once young and foolish, now acquiring the wisdom of age. This is why the last days of Lincoln were not entirely forlorn.